So, to start with, here's probably the most well-known verse from the Dhammapada. Hatred never ends through hatred. By love alone does it end. This is an ancient truth. And you may have heard this verse. The Dhammapada is one of the oldest and most beloved of the Buddhist texts, and it's a condensation of some of Buddha's earliest essential teachings. And it was passed on orally until it was written down on palm leaves almost 500 years after Buddha's death. So it's a mystery how these things get transmitted. And we don't know how exactly accurate these are the very words that Buddha said. It took 500 years to write them down, and they've been written down and translated many times since. So it's probably a living, changing text. Who knows? But I'm sure that much of it is the essence of what the Buddha taught. And it's a really nice, straightforward, down-to-earth text. In Everyday Zen, we had just been studying the Avatamsaka Sutra, which some of you may be familiar with, the flower ornament sutra, and it is the opposite of clear and down to earth. It's very flowery and beautiful, and full of jewels and palaces and descriptions of many, many bodhisattvas rising from under the earth and stuff. And which is lovely, and it's very, very long, and the Dhammapada is very short, and it's very straightforward, and it's easy to understand, so it's kind of a nice change. It was a relief. It's also not just brass tacks. It's got beautiful metaphors in it. It's quite poetic and written in verse, and many of you may be familiar with it. I'm ashamed to say, was not familiar with it. I'd never studied it in all these years until we just did this past fall, and we're still studying it. Anyway, it's really been helpful to me, and one of the reasons I'm talking about it is because it has been encouraging to me in these difficult times and in these recent months. The text I have been using and that I will be quoting from is a translation by Gil Fronsdale, which I recommend. So here are the first two verses. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of an ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never-departing shadow. So these two verses really lay out the basic premise of the Dhammapada, that it's through the training of our own mind that we can find freedom. The Dhammapada is urging us to let go of craving, let go of attachment, let go of preferences. And I've been practicing Zen for a long time, as Jim just said, 50 years. And I must admit that all this time I've been longing to find freedom from craving. And I haven't quite gotten there yet. I still have some craving. There's been some pain in my practice sometimes that, why can't I let go of self-clinging? But I think that's partly because, or mostly because, I'm a human being. So, but also sometimes I get discouraged that the Buddha's teachings ask of me more than an ordinary person can do. Well, in this way, and the Dhammapada is very clear on this, that if you want joy and happiness and freedom, then you need to do these things, release your clinging and you release your attachments. And so I say to myself, well, can I really and truly let go of attachments? Can I really and truly let go of self-clinging? Can I let go of the wish for my loved ones not to suffer? Can I let go of self-clinging? Can I let go of my wish for the Democrats to turn everything around in the midterm election? Can I let go of craving? No, I can't, because I'm human. And I think that's okay. I forgive myself for that. And I can maintain the intention to do so and guide myself by that intention. So that's what I do. I have an ongoing practice in that way. We all can do that. Early in my life, I made an attempt to train myself to let go of clinging, though I never would have used those words. When I was 10, I went through a period of thinking that I was a really selfish person and I should do something about it. In retrospect, I don't think I was any more selfish than your average 10-year-old, but for some reason, I was unusually aware of it. I wanted to be a good person, but please don't think I was a goody-goody. I trespassed into neighbors' yards to climb their trees. I stole an antique pillbox off my grandmother's dresser. I felt very guilty about it, but I never told her, and I never gave it back. I snuck into the kitchen and took Oreo cookies out of the unopened... I opened the bag and took the Oreo cookies out and ate them, of course. And I'm ashamed to say I joined others in teasing a boy in third grade who was awkward and gangly. So my 10-year-old investigation of selfishness was born not so much out of virtue, but out of the curiosity I've had all my life about what is it to be a person? What does it mean to be a person? Where did I end and the other person begin? Why did each person see the world from inside their own head? I shouldn't put this in the past. Where do I end and the other person begin? Why does each person see the world from inside their own head? Why can't we all read each other's minds? I couldn't really understand that. It seemed it would be much more natural if we could just see what was going on inside everybody's head. At any rate, I embarked on a training program of doing extra things for people, doing favors for my parents, like clearing the table before they asked me to, or giving a favorite book to a friend. But I saw that I was only doing these things for others I was only doing these things in order to be praised, or because I hoped people would like me better. And I knew that that was still very selfish. So I took what I thought was the next step, and I did generous things for others without telling them so that I wouldn't get any credit, like emptying the teacher's wastebasket at recess or leaving a packet of M&Ms in a classmate's desk who wasn't particularly my friend and wouldn't guess that I had done it. But this didn't last long. I said to myself, you're not doing this to be kind. You're doing this so you can tell yourself what a great person you are. My self-training program hadn't worked. I threw up my hands and abandoned the project, at least for the time being. And at some level, I'm still struggling in the same way. I still want everyone to like me, and I still want to be a good person. But my life doesn't depend on it. And I don't believe my life depends on it in the way I sometimes believed in the past. And I can also forgive myself for the self-clinging that comes up. I can forgive myself for hoping that the Democrats win the midterm election. And I don't think that, I hope that's not really what is meant by letting go of clinging, but it might be included in that. Anyway, because I'm human, I know I don't expect to complete this project of letting go of self-clinging in this lifetime. And I have made some strides, so I am glad for that. I don't crave things anymore. Getting old is very helpful in this project of letting go of preferences and letting go of clinging. Because, for example, with things, at this point, and this age, I find I'm starting to prefer the empty space things leave behind when I give them away to the things themselves. Extra clothes, books, woven baskets, all kinds of things that I don't need to cling to anymore. But more important than things, I have getting old helps me to let go of clinging to self, because it's hard to cling to a self that's falling apart at the seams. So aging gives us an extra boost in letting go of self-clinging. So back to the Dhammapada. From a Zen perspective, it might appear to be dualistic. It seems to be dividing everything into the wrong way and the right way to do things. Returning to the opening verses that I just read, the second half of each verse is, "Speak or act with a corrupted mind and suffering follows, as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox," which is a beautiful metaphor. "Speak or act with a peaceful mind and happiness follows, like a never-departing shadow," another beautiful metaphor. But anyway, they're like, well, you better do this, or that's going to happen to you, and you should do this, and then you'll be happy. So reading the Dhammapada, I thought at first, oh, no, here's another teaching that's telling me to do the impossible. Here's another example from the Dhammapada, a verse. "As a solid mass of rock is not moved by the wind, so a wise person is unmoved by praise or blame." How could I ever be a wise person like this? What about when I have a book or an article published? I do care whether it's met with praise or blame. And you don't have to be a writer to care. Whatever work you do, if it matters to you, if you put your heart into it, can you really be unmoved by whether the response is praise or blame? Another verse says, "The wise person shows no sign of being elated or depressed. When an old friend I haven't seen for a while comes for a visit, I show plentiful signs of being elated." So I want to say to the Dhammapada, you've got to be kidding. This path is impossible. What hope is there for me? But wait, then, after I'd been studying it for a while, everything kind of swung around and I had an aha moment that the Dhammapada is an early version of a self-help book. The Dhammapada is not addressing sages who have already attained a selfless state and are free from suffering. What would be the point of that? The teaching is meant to help us, not lecture us. Here's another verse. Whoever recovers from doing evil by doing something wholesome illuminates the world like the moon set free from a cloud. So there's hope. This is reassuring. Even if you do something evil, you can do something wholesome and you can recover. The book is really addressing ordinary people like you and me, people who are not yet free from the suffering of clinging, and who could use some suggestions about how to train themselves, ourselves, to walk that path. The Dhammapada is giving us friendly encouragement. The text says, "Happiness is steadfast faith. This includes steadfast faith in oneself and in one's good intentions. I can do this. I can walk this path." Going back to the opening lines, what we are today... Oh, this isn't exactly the opening lines, but it's early on. "What we are today comes from our thoughts of yesterday, and our present thoughts build our life of tomorrow. Our life is the creation of our mind." The Dhammapada emphasizes training the mind. Joy can come with training the mind. To train is to change. You train a dog in order to change its behavior. Changing habits of thinking is extremely difficult. But all Dharma teachings, in fact, Buddhist practice itself, is based on the idea that it is possible. Changing karmic patterns is an ongoing process. It's not something we can ever finish with. That's the point. This is what our lives are made of. If my thoughts of today build my life tomorrow, then how about putting aside my idea that I can never be free from clinging? Don't have that be what's building my life of tomorrow, that thought. Over and over, the text says that I am the only one who can train myself. It's important, the Buddha tells us, to keep company with the wise and to learn from them. But changing my habits of thinking is up to me, and I am up to it. The Dhammapada wants me to succeed. Buddha tells me to be tender with myself. Here's another verse. If one knew oneself to be precious, one would guard oneself with care. Sages will watch over themselves all through the night. So I'm grateful for Buddha's encouragement. He's cheering me on, or she. The Dhammapada says that every person wants happiness and that letting go of craving will bring you joy. I'm glad the Dhammapada allows us to want to be happy. The Dalai Lama co-wrote a book called The Art of Happiness. And if he wrote a book on the subject, it makes it legitimate to want to be happy. In the preface, he says, if you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want yourself to be happy, practice compassion. So happiness follows from compassion. I think of Vipassana teacher James Barres's year-long course, Awakening Joy. He created this course about 20 years ago and taught it at first in a big hall in Berkeley. But it has been available to people to take online all over the world. Thousands of people have taken this course. I took it myself 1 year when it was in person in Berkeley. And it, too, is a training program with certain exercises and homework assignments. I particularly appreciated James's inclusion of gratitude practice. Every night before you go to bed, write down 3 things you're grateful for from that day. It's really effective. Some of you have probably already done it, but I highly encourage it. James is not teaching about a selfish kind of happiness. He's talking about the kind of joy that connects you to everyone and makes you want to help others be happy along with yourself. He's a Vipassana teacher whose mindfulness practice is interwoven with a commitment to working for social and environmental justice. He does a lot of that directly, too. In the last few decades, we've seen a lot of self-help books and programs about happiness coming out. The good ones, anyway, do not tell us how to get the things we want, like a new car, as much as they tell us how to find happiness inside, in our minds and hearts, without changing our outward circumstances. We may think we will be happy in a different external situation, and perhaps we will be for a little while. But as you know, when you have satisfied one specific craving, another one comes along behind it pretty quickly. This is the second noble truth, actually. Suffering is caused by craving. So again, back to this opening verse. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never-departing shadow. In the Zen tradition, we tend to steer clear of the idea that practice will make you happy. We don't sit zazen with gaining mind. We sit zazen to sit zazen, and if it happens to make us feel better, that's just a side benefit. But Zen is not as different as it might seem. Zen asks us to be present with things as they are. But it doesn't say that everything's okay the way it is. We have the precepts reminding us that it's not okay to murder and steal. We take vows to save beings from suffering. Zen respects the earliest Buddhist teachings, including the Dhammapada. After all, Zen is Buddhism. Both Zen and the Dhammapada teach us that we create suffering for ourselves with our minds. Both teach us that letting go of clinging is at the heart of practice and that freedom is possible. Our happiness and the happiness of others are completely connected. The Dhammapada says, all tremble at violence, all fear death. Putting oneself in the place of another, one should not kill or cause another to kill. This teaching calls for empathy. It's not abstract. Is appropriate to the turmoil of this moment. It asks us to recognize ourselves in the frightened father who is pulled from his family and in the mother and children left behind not knowing where he has been taken. As concerned Buddhist practitioners, we can find ways to engage, to meet hatred with love. Again, hatred never ends by hatred. By love alone does it end. This is an ancient truth. So I want to turn to a different time and a different tradition of Buddhist teachings and to speak about a koan, one that is also appropriate to the time we are living in. There's a wonderful book by Joan Sutherland about koans and different ways of practicing with koans. It's called Through Forests of Every Color, and I recommend it if you haven't read it. It's not just for Rinzai people who are practicing in that koan tradition. It's for anyone who's interested in the koans. And koans are a part of the Zen tradition too, and of the Soto tradition too. Dogen has many writings and fascicles on koans. So when koan practice began to develop in 8th century China, it was a time of terrible devastation when the An Lu Shan rebellion against the Tang dynasty ravaged the countryside, and 2/3 of the entire population of China died in 10 years. That's amazing. That was in the 8th century, or the end of the 8th century. So it was really terrible violence. Some Chan monasteries provided food and refuge, and some teachers, notably Matsu and Chirtu, traveled around from village to village to see and engage with suffering people. As Sutherland says, for them, Chan practice wasn't about getting free of the world, it was about being free in the world. Stories were told and retold about their conversations with lay people and with other monks, in which they encouraged people to let go of habitual thinking. They talked about hoeing the field, foraging for food, cooking rice for each other. To quote Sutherland again, they embraced the great matter of their time, asking, "What do we do now, we 1 in 3 who survive?" As the stories were retold and passed on, they became the koans that were studied for hundreds of years and that we still study today. One of my favorite koans is the well-known one about stepping off a 100-foot pole. What? Stepping off a 100-foot pole? It goes like this. You who sit on the top of a 100-foot pole, although you have entered the way, it is not genuine. Take a step from the top of the pole and reveal your true body in the 10 directions. Being at the top of a 100-foot pole can mean that you have ascended to a nearly impossible height. Through hard practice, you have gotten as high as you can go and have achieved a state of enlightenment. Or it can mean that you find yourself stuck in a spot where it feels dangerous to move in any direction. You're frozen there by fear or frozen by self-satisfaction. In any case, there's not a lot to do up there, and there's not even room to sit down. Pretty much the only thing left to do is step off. This requires courage, of course. It requires throwing yourself into the whole universe. It requires letting go of who and what you think you are and being willing to enter the unknown. It means letting go of your fine Zen attainment and your fine but lonely spot on high and returning to the nitty-gritty world where people suffer and struggle, the world you are a part of, whether you like it or not. You are not separate after all. I really like this koan. It's extreme and it grabs my attention. If I was literally on the top of a 100-foot pole, I doubt I would step off. I would probably call 911 on my cell phone and hope for a helicopter. But it's a great metaphor. Now and then I do say to myself, "Okay, Sue, take a deep breath and step off the top of the 100-foot pole." I picture myself precariously balanced at the top of a telephone pole. That's how I see it in my mind. But it turns out that a telephone pole, the average residential telephone pole, I looked this up, is about 50 feet high. So you'd have to be on the top of 2 telephone poles to be on the top of a 100-foot pole, and that's pretty darn high. It's pretty scary. So sometimes this stepping off into space might mean making a difficult decision that I've been wavering about. or making a painful but necessary phone call to a loved one when I don't know what's going to come out of it, or letting go of habitual thinking about who I am. It could mean something more straightforward, like leaving a job that you know isn't right for you without knowing what's next. It's time now for me, for at least two reasons, to let go of the calm and predictable path of my days and throw myself into the fray, not knowing. One reason is that I'm old and getting older fast, and my friends are dying, and I'm losing physical strength and mental acuity, so I have to enter the unknown. The other reason is that for all of us, whatever age we are, there really is no calm and predictable path in the times we're living in. Probably it has never been possible for humans to follow a calm and predictable path with certainty. But it's more evident to me now than it used to be to me. I'm not saying we shouldn't regulate our lives and our days as best we can. It's helpful and steadying. First thing, when you get up in the morning, it's helpful to have a cup of green tea while you sit in your armchair and look out the window to see the trees across the street light up with morning sun. Next, to have a morning sit, followed by a morning walk, followed by breakfast of granola and yogurt. This is a very good morning routine. As you might suspect, I'm speaking personally here. But the world outside my window, which is, after all, the world I live in, is not predictable. So when I step out the door, either literally or even digitally, you go places digitally, I have to enter the fray. This might mean simply going to a demonstration or standing in support of day laborers in front of Home Depot, or it might mean speaking of stepping off the 100-foot pole, that is what day laborers are already doing themselves just by waiting on a street corner for work. So how do you step off the top of a 100-foot pole? What does it mean in your life? Moving ahead another couple of 100 years, I'll end my talk with a coda from Dogen. In 13th century Japan, in the Kamakura period, Dogen was also teaching at a time of great turmoil and violence. Dogen often spoke about time. He said that every moment is important. Every moment matters. Every moment is the right moment to respond to whatever needs responding to. In Uji, his fascicle on time, which is so wonderful and complex, he says, "Do not think that time merely flies away. If time merely flies away, you would be separated from time. But you yourself are time. So, since we are time, we have some kind of a control of time. We don't need to wait until just the right time arrives in order to act. All times are the right time. Every moment is a decision-making moment. Every moment is a moral moment that can contribute to the greater good. And it doesn't have to be some grand gesture, but every moment counts. We are already Buddhas, and we can embody our Buddha nature in the present moment." So I'll end again with a repetition of this stanza from the Dhammapada. "Hatred never ends by hatred. By love alone does it end. This is an ancient truth."